Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and for many years I did live radio. Then I transitioned to the podcast world where I feel I found my home. I love talking about spiritual formation, justice issues, and spiritual practices. Throw in the Enneagram, movies, and current events from time to time, and that's what you get on the podcast. I'm glad you've come along for the ride. Welcome to Faith Conversations. Welcome to Faith Conversations. You're going to be glad that you downloaded this episode. I've been waiting, and finally am thrilled to be able to have Jamar Tisby on the podcast. Many of you know that he is the author of an amazing book that is getting a lot of press right now called The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism. And if you're not familiar with Jamar, apart from that title, he is the president of The Witness, a Black Christian collective, where he writes about race, religion, politics, and culture. He's also co-host of the Pass the Mic podcast, and he speaks at conferences around the country. Maybe you've seen his writing in the New York Times or The Atlantic or with CNN. So I want to welcome Jamar Tisby to the podcast. Welcome, Jamar.
It is a pleasure to be on the mic with a pro.
Well, this is thank fun. You. I'm delighted to have you. And also delighted to have my son back on the podcast. John Lustria joins me from time to time. So I want to welcome him back. For those who don't know, he is the education coordinator at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine. So welcome back to you, John.
Thanks. You can't get rid of me.
That's right. I cannot, thankfully. And one of the reasons I've asked John to be a part of the podcast today is, Jamar, you talk of this wide swath of history, important swath of history, and you know, John's been my own personal Civil War scholar in my back pocket that I could ask questions to, and I thought it would be just fun to have him along on this podcast because he might ask some questions that just don't come up for me or some things that I might miss. But I want to start at the beginning. I think it's always interesting why people choose to write about the things that they do. I will say that what grabbed my attention after I saw the title, The Color of Compromise, was The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism. And I thought, okay, I've got to read this because I'm part of the American Church and I'm white. And I knew that I wanted to read this book. But for you, why did you choose to write about racism and religion, the two together? And why now for you?
So I really wanted to start by writing a book about fighting racism and what to do in practical steps. But in conversations with agents and editors and whatnot, it became apparent that I was really passionate about building the foundation, because the reason I was so adamant that we had to do something now is because I was learning the history of what happened before. And so this all comes about 2014, 2015, 2016, in the height of the Black Lives Matter movement. And this is also when it's really because of Ferguson that I got an interest in the academic study of history, because I was trying to figure out, like so many others, what was going on and how did we get here? And I found that historians often had the most helpful things to say. They were able to talk about redlining and restrictive covenants and connect the police force to slave patrols. And they had all of this historical context that helped unravel the complexities and why we are right now. So I wanted to access that. So I started taking graduate courses in history, and it blew my mind. I took my first graduate course in history was at Jackson State University. It was called History of the New South. And so it was from Civil War, Reconstruction on up to the late 20th century. And so a big bulk of that was the history of lynching. And as I read that history, the absolute brutality and inhumanity. And the irony is the lynchers accused the lynchees of brutality and inhumanity, but really it was they who were enacting it upon other image bearers, right? And then when I got into the PhD program in history at the University of Mississippi, it was more of the same. It didn't matter what era of U.S. history. It didn't matter what region or even what sector. You could be talking about labor. You could be talking about race. You could be talking about war, whatever it might be. Racism was rampant. And whenever Christians were talked about, it was usually white Christians being on the wrong side of history, so to speak. And so I was angry. I was upset. I was frustrated, and I wanted to do something about that. And I wanted other people to know what I now knew historically. And so that's where this idea came about.
And I love that. You wanted other people to know what you now knew, which I think is this big assumption. I certainly made an assumption that I maybe didn't know this because I'm white, but my Black friends, Black brothers and sisters in Christ, they knew this history. And I realized that was not true because we were all going to the same schools, right?
Yep.
Yeah. The subtext of all of this and of the book, which covers some just incredible historical ground. I mean, it's tough to cram it all in there. And, you know, you know as well as I, there's so much more to be explored that you don't get into. I mean, it's so hard to pack all that into, you know, as you stated in the introduction, like a historical survey. But the subtext of all of this and, you know, the crux of the book is that we desperately need some education reform, the way that, you know, our history gets taught to us, you know, in schools, which, I mean, we're going to talk more specifically about the church, but I want to underscore that that's kind of the subtext of all this conversation.
Look, that is a fantastic, fantastic point. If we got the history even a little more right, even a little bit more robust, maybe the struggles wouldn't be quite as hard because there's just such misinformation and lack of information about there. I love that point.
And to that point, I think that's probably why I got so excited about the book as I started to read it. And, you know, I thought, okay, I've talked, I'm not educated like my son is immersed in all of this Civil War history, but I've been able to dialogue and ask questions through the years as he's been in school. So not all of this was new to me, but there was plenty of it that was new to me. And I thought, all of this is going to be new to some friends that I know, and the church needs to be reading this. I'm excited. My church is reading this as a church. You know, whoever will decide to sign on and read and discuss it. And I think it's super important from that perspective. Just the educational piece. This will be mind blowing for many people. Yeah, John.
Yeah. Well, so I think it'd be great to start just with defining some terms. Specifically with racism, what exactly it is, and well, there's somewhere I want to go after that, but let's start with that. Sure. So what is racism anyway?
Yes, it is super important to define our terms because especially with a word as controversial and as fraught as racism, different people mean different things. So I say in the introduction for The Color of Compromise, I'm borrowing from a social psychologist named Beverly Daniel Tatum, who defines racism as a system of advantage based on race. And then another shorthand definition that floats around that I think is helpful is racism is prejudice plus power. Both of those definitions in using that word system and then power get at this really important dynamic that racism goes beyond just someone's personal feelings toward other folks. It has to do with the way we set up society. It has to do with the way we deploy power. It has to do with the way we distribute benefits and advantages. And it's not the same for every group. So we live in a white supremacist society, which puts white people at the center or on top of this social hierarchy. That means they're afforded more privileges, more benefits, more advantage for being considered white. And then other people, people of color, and especially Black people, have many, many disadvantages based on that. This is important because not only does it move us to thinking beyond the individualistic manifestations of racism, but it also sort of subtly refutes this idea of reverse racism, which in certain circles, they'll explain it this way. Let's say anyone can be prejudiced. Anyone can, no matter what their race or ethnicity, can have biased feelings towards someone and mistreat them because of perceived differences. That's just human, right? But not every group or individual has power behind it to make their prejudice into policy, right? Not every group was able to impose, say, race-based chattel slavery. Not every group was able to enforce segregation. Not every group is able to even have encounters with the police that end up being non-lethal, right? So it's the idea that racism fundamentally is an issue of power as well as prejudice.
That's such a great point. And then the other thing that I wanted to mention, and we'll talk more about this whole idea that on an individual level, because of, like, you're absolutely right to point towards the larger systemic issues of it, but, you know, people, it's not like a kind of a binary thing. People either, let me see if I can phrase this right, they aren't racists or not racists or whatever. There's this whole, you know, just because you're not in the KKK doesn't make you a, you know, right, not a racist. There's kind of a gradation to this, if that's the right word, that I think can often get lost.
That's a massively important point. We do think in terms of binaries, either I'm racist or not racist, which is why when you bring up racism, people reflexively say, I'm not racist, not realizing there's this whole other category. So the way I typically explain it is you're either actively racist, passively racist, or actively anti-racist. And there's no in between. You're either supporting racism actively, or you're supporting it passively, or you're actively working against it. And I think that's the whole idea of compromise and complicity. A lot of people sort of, I tried to explain this in the introduction, but, you know, careful reading is at a premium these days. Nevertheless, I try to explain, you know, there are plenty of people who committed egregious acts of racism. Like, I begin with the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. And, you know, it's an act of racial terror, and somebody literally planned and planted and lit dynamite to kill people, right? But there was a whole community of white people in Birmingham who didn't actually plant the dynamite. Are they therefore absolved? Are they therefore not racist? And I try to make this point with the speech by Charles Morgan Jr., who's a white lawyer in Birmingham, and he gives a speech to an all-white men's business club. And he says, who did it? Who threw that bomb? Was it a Negro or a white? And then he says these chilling words, the answer should be, we all did it. And what he's getting at there is the complicity or the passivity or the silence or the apathy of a great majority of white Christians in the face of acts of racial terror. They also contributed to it happening. And I say that the most egregious acts of racism can only happen within a context of compromise. And so I want to press upon us that we are either involved actively in dismantling racism, or we're involved passively or actively in promoting racism.
Yeah, it gets to the whole idea of power, you know, whether you're allowing, you know, the power that's being wielded in society by either by powerful individuals, you know, on a national or a local level, you know, allowing that power to be wielded in a bad way, or, you know, resisting it or trying to make that power be wielded in a positive way. And it, like, I think it's so easy for that to be invisible, but it, like, being called to pay attention to that power and how it's being wielded is one of the great challenges of the book that I think you call us to.
One of the things that came to mind as you were just talking, Jamar, I think about how easy it is for us to point the finger back to the 50s, the 60s, and say, wow, that wouldn't have been me, you know? And to say, oh, things have changed. I think what changes that argument today is Ferguson, is, I mean, you start listing, and more recently, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd. I mean, you know, you can't, I don't think you can even in good conscience even begin to give the argument that that much has changed, and that, oh, I've been a part of this great role of history of moving things forward. That talk about then and now, and I might be jumping ahead way too quickly, but that's where that's what I think about.
Right, because there's an ideology that undergirds all of this. One of the things I say in the book is that racism never goes away; it just adapts. And so we can think of three main movements in U.S. history of how racism manifests: race-based chattel slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and now what some have called a racialized society. Emerson and Smith talk about this in their book, Divided by Faith, where any sort of major quality of life factor, from health to education to wealth, all falls predictably along racial lines still. And so these are different ways. So racism looks different in 2020 than it did in 1920 than it did in 1820.
Just say coronavirus. Just say right. Coronavirus, and we see that, you know, medical, when you listed yeah. those categories, like, excuse me, right? Health,
exactly.
Economically, all of that, you know,
predictable, unfortunately, grimly predictable along those racial and economic lines. And so one of the things that I try to explain is, you know, when people, as we look back at the 50s and 60s, especially, and say, oh, well, we've made such progress, we've come so far, racism is a thing of the past. No, it's not, because the story we tell ourselves about race remains. And so some call this white supremacy, right, which I explained earlier. Others call it the narrative of racial difference. And it is the social story that we wrap around race, and the meaning that we put around these physical differences in appearance. And Bryan Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative put it this way. He said, the North won the Civil War, but the South won the narrative war. And I think that's so true. You see this narrative war being played out in every argument over Confederate monument and statues. You see this being played out over the names of football teams. You see this being played out over kneeling at flags because it's supposedly a sign of patriotism or anti-patriotism, based on how you respond, right? And so this narrative of racial difference, or this idea or mythology of white supremacy, is critical. And until we dismantle that narrative and tell a different story, a more inclusive story, we'll continue to struggle with different manifestations of racism.
I personally appreciate, and we talked, several weeks ago with an author, speaker, pastor named Daniel Hill. Maybe you know Daniel, a good friend. We used to live in Chicago, so a good friend from there. And he really is adamant and of calling this white supremacy.
Yes.
And I appreciate that. I think that's something that we need to get used to hearing, because that really is the reality. I think that, what was the other term? Racial
narrative of racial difference.
Yeah. I think that just is a soft sell term, you know? And so I appreciate the white supremacy term, and then learning really what that means. John, I see you taking a breath to ask something.
I mean, agreeing that there is a problem is the first step to, you know, kind of getting anywhere. And I think because of the way that education's done in the country, and, you know, the way kind of racism both is and mostly is not talked about, you know, inside the church, there's just this kind of, there's not an acknowledgement by so many that there's even a problem at all in the first place. And there's a great quote that you have in here. So the longstanding failure among many white Christians to acknowledge ongoing discrimination embedded in systems and structures means black and white Christians often talk past each other. One group focuses on isolated incidents, the other sees a pattern of injustice. And so it's the trouble with, you know, kind of racism as it exists today is it's so hard to even agree on kind of the basics of the conversation we're even trying to have.
I think one of the biggest misunderstandings between Black and white Christians that we have to untangle, and honestly, mostly it's on the response, it's on the side of white Christians, is the idea that racism is individual and personal rather than systemic and institutional. And the sort of obvious examples of this are instances of police brutality. And so for my generation, we got a glimpse of this when Trayvon Martin was killed, right? Mm-hmm. And this idea of policing Black bodies, this is a neighborhood you shouldn't be in because it's quote unquote ours, even though the killer in this instance was had a Hispanic and Latin ancestry. Then, of course, Mike Brown's killing. And it was so interesting. There were two Department of Justice reports that came out afterwards. Most people remember one or the other. So a lot of people look at the report on the incident itself, how Mike Brown ended up dead. And it demonstrated that Mike Brown had gunpowder residue on his hand, that based on the location of the bullets in his body, it was likely that he did not have his hands up, which we remember the chant, hands up, don't shoot. And so they'll point to that, as well as the video of Mike Brown before in the convenience store, roughing up the store clerk. And they'll point to that and say, see, he had it coming. He was a quote unquote thug. He was a criminal, et cetera, et cetera. And they'll look at Black people who are outraged at this and say, what are you talking about? He brought it on himself. And we're saying, no, you're forgetting the animosity and the contentious relationship between Black people and the police. And this is longstanding. We can go back to Trayvon Martin. That was a neighborhood watch guy, but taking on the mantle of police, basically. We can look at Eric Garner, which happened also in 2014. We can look at Sean Bell and Amadou Diallo. We can look at Rodney King. We can look at how the Watts Uprising started in 1965. We can look at the Tulsa Massacre. All of these things have a pattern of animosity toward Black people and between Black people and law enforcement. And that's the institutional and systemic nature of racism. We could cite many other examples, of course, in the health field or in residential discrimination, in school segregation, you name it. But Black people as a community, because we've been the victims of racism so often, are able to see a little more clearly the pattern of racism in our communities.
It was interesting to me reading the book. I have to say that I really did not understand and see how far back the issue of police brutality went. I thought, oh, this must be much more recent. And I'm reading, I'm like, my mouth is, dropping open more and more. That was probably my big eye-opening moment, was on that specific issue, which is not a small issue. At all.
Right.
Yeah.
And we just had another incident as we're recording this.
That's right. In Kenosha.
Jacob Blake in Kenosha. And that's 20 minutes from where I grew up. Ooh. And to communicate for folks, this is the issue of police brutality and especially the killing of unarmed Black people. Thankfully, Jacob Blake is still alive, but latest word is that he's paralyzed from the waist down. But the issue is not simply the murders themselves, it's the terror that it inflicts on Black people. So this is how I processed this latest incident. Mm-hmm. I heard another Black person had been shot who was unarmed. And of course, my heart sank. Then I heard it was in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I grew up in Illinois near the border. And so Kenosha is in our vernacular. It's in my memory. It's part of my growing up. And then I know that my brother lives in the vicinity, minutes away. And my first thought is it him?
Right.
Because it very well could be.
Right.
As a Black man, he could be this victim of police brutality. Come to find out, it's Jacob Blake, but Jacob Blake is shot in front of his children. he was breaking up a fight, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the unpredictability of it. It's the seeming randomness of it, right? Like, we know in the abstract, there's this issue with police and we try our best to avoid them. But we also don't know when someone is going to suddenly decide you're a threat and decide that they need to use lethal force to restrain you. And that's the terror that we walk around with every time. I won't even say every time we leave the house, because Breonna Taylor was in her house asleep. And that's part of the issue of anti-Black police brutality, is the terror of it all, never knowing when you or someone you love might be a victim.
And it evokes for me, I'm not someone that watches a lot of horror movies anyway, but it evokes for me the most horrifying trope of all horror tropes, is that whenever, you know, whoever the person is, the victim, they're fleeing, and they flee to a place where they're confident that they'll be safe. And suddenly the person or entity that, you know, they think they're going to be safe with suddenly is now out to get them. It just produces this fear that, you know, no place is safe. Even if there's a small piece of your brain that realizes that, you know, there probably is someplace somewhere, you can't escape it. It dominates your brain. I mean, it's for me, one of the most horrifying things to imagine.
It reminds me of the story of a lynching I told in the book. It happened in 1904 in Sunflower County. But the lynching itself took place on the grounds of a Black church, which I just thought was so profound for the reasons you just mentioned. This place that should be a sanctuary and a refuge becomes a place of terror. And it's almost as if, I mean, it was strategically chosen by the white lynchers, and it was a mob of people who not only conducted the lynching, but there was a massive audience as well. It was a strategic choice to inflict maximum terror on not just the victims of the lynching, but the Black community as a whole. And it was as if to say, not even God can protect you from our wrath, which is horrifying to think about.
So I sit here today, I'm 60 years old, white woman, John, my son, 27, soon to be 28, white young man, and Jamar, I don't know how old you are. I don't know if you want to tell, but anyway, but my thought is, I'm sitting here going, I wonder how many times, I know how many times I've been pulled over, and I know how many tickets I've received. Zero, pulled over twice, zero tickets. John, I don't know about you, what you've told me, what you haven't as a son.
Here it comes.
But pulled over twice, one ticket.
Okay.
Wow.
Jamar, let's hear. Can you count? I don't know. I want to think it'd be helpful for the audience to hear this.
Yeah, over a dozen times for sure. And that's on the low end, probably, for Black men. There was a stretch in about a 3 to 4 month period where I got pulled over four times, and I had my most harrowing encounter one of those times. And this is on a rural road in Mississippi. The cop was tailing me, but I wasn't quite sure. I turned off onto a smaller road, which was even more frightening. Mm-hmm. And he followed me. And as soon as I had turned off, his lights come on. And his reason for pulling me over was really interesting. He said, "No one ever comes down this road except to do drugs or sell drugs." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And on that basis, he searched my car. He had me to get out, put my hands on the hood, asked me, do I have any objects that might point or stick him, expecting, or at least taking precautions, whether I might have a drug needle, searched me. And throughout this entire incident, there are two things. Number one, people always say, well, why didn't they just comply? I don't think people understand the sheer terror of knowing that someone with a gun that can kill you and a badge that can exonerate them can do whatever they want. Literally whatever they want. And this is before Black Lives Matter. This is before body cameras, right? And then the second thing is the utter violation of your person. Like, they have complete control of your body at that point. They can handcuff you. They can taser you. They can shoot you. They can put you in the back of a car. They can put you behind bars. And all of that anxiety and trauma. And when you're in that situation, you're not just thinking about yourself, you're thinking about all the other encounters you've personally had and all the other encounters every Black man I know has had. It's just, it's almost too much for words.
Yeah. Just, you know, I tell people, watch Just Mercy.
Yes.
And watch what happened the first time Bryan Stevenson tried to come into the prison to see, to meet with some clients. You know, what happened to him as a Black lawyer did not happen.
We talked about the, you know, power, prejudice with power. And of course that's a prime example. And we've talked a lot about systems, as we should, but sometimes that prejudice with power happens in a one-on-one interaction.
Yes. Yes. Multiplied thousands of times, right? 4,000, nearly 5,000 lynchings that we know of, and who knows how many instances of police brutality have not been caught on cell phone video, or whose victims have not become hashtags, right? So it's a massive issue, and this is one of the things that compelled me to write the book as well. Was in the midst of the Ferguson uprisings, you had that phrase Black Lives Matter, and then you would have people retort either all lives matter or blue lives matter, right? And so often it was coming from white evangelical Christians who were seeing BLM just as this terrorist, liberal, socialist, Marxist organization, every label, every epithet to sort of dismiss these claims and cries for justice. And meanwhile, it wasn't just that, they were doubling down on forces of oppression, which historically police and law enforcement and the criminal injustice system have been towards the Black community. So it's this, it's really interesting thing where it's not just a denial of the claims of the victims, it is a doubling down in the defense of the perpetrators, which is one of the things that, A, I thought knowing history provides some helpful context, because this is not the first time, it's not original, it's nothing new in US history. And B, it gives us the context for understanding why we're facing what we're facing right now.
So I want to ask some questions based on what you just said. I have the perception, I'd like to hear your perception, that more people are listening right now, that more people are deciding to become aware. I would love, this comes up in circles that where I live and breathe and move. And, you know, Black Lives Matter, that whole thing will come up. It's this organization, doesn't it have these Marxist beginnings? And I don't know, this, that, and the other thing. Talk about movement versus organization. Just speak to that for a moment, would you?
Yeah. I would agree with you that more people are listening. And, you know, we have to walk and chew gum at the same time that it is good news and progress that more people are listening. I think 2020 is different from 2015, you know, even just 5 years ago, as far as how the conversation is being held, the constituents who are participating. I think it shows progress. At the same time, we have to be very cautious that conversations and words aren't the sum total of the action, right? Mm-hmm. Without actually transforming systems, policies, and institutions. I think one of the impediments is what you brought up, that there's this constant debate about the organization versus the sentiment or the idea. This is the way I recently thought about it. There are a lot of white Christians who can affirm Black Lives Matter in principle because it doesn't cost them anything at this point, right? And I would say if you're in an environment where just saying Black Lives Matter is costly, in 2020, I don't know how much they're going to change. I'm not telling you to leave. I'm just saying they've got all the evidence they need to affirm a simple principle, which I think, if we look at it theologically, is rooted in the Imago Dei in Genesis 1, 26 through 28, and all people being made in the image of God, right? Yes. It's not that difficult a concept for Christians or people of faith to grasp.
Yes.
And so if you're in an environment where it is still difficult, that says a lot. But by and large, I see a lot of white Christians affirming the principle Black Lives Matter. But it's sort of akin to saying red and yellow, black and white, all are equal in God's sight, right? It's become this platitude, this trope, this way of asserting one's own racial innocence. Because I can say Black Lives Matter, I can affirm it. But then when you get down to it and the claims that Black Lives Matter demands, that's when it gets troublesome. And so here's what I think about the organization. I think that if Christians are really troubled by the platform on the BLM webpage, and the question is, what is the equivalent that is Christian? What movement is as massive or as potent as the Black Lives Matter movement? I would also say this, have you done more than explore a webpage as far as the organization? Because there are many, many chapters, and BLM is intentionally decentralized. So every chapter has its own sort of personality. And I would also say there are plenty of Christians involved in BLM, both as a broader movement and the organization. And I say the broader movement because it's this really potent phrase that can mean a lot of different things, right? So we talked about it on a theological level. BLM is also an organization. BLM is also a movement that it transcends organizations. And so a lot of civil rights and justice organizations are part of the movement without necessarily being part of BLM proper as an organization. So at the end of the day, what I find is when Christians really bring up, well, what about the organization or the movement? And even I, in the Color of Compromise, compare and contrast them. So Black people do this too. But over the course of the years since BLM became a nationally known, what I've seen is it's often the organization is often brought up as an excuse or a reason not to get involved.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
My husband calls it whataboutism.
It is absolutely whataboutism. Yeah. And it's not necessarily what people are demanding. What we're demanding is justice for Breonna Taylor. What we're demanding is an end to anti-Black police brutality. We're not demanding that you get involved with any particular organization. So you got problems with BLM as a Christian? Well, number one, are you afraid of losing your religion? Like, it's not going to rub off on you. It's not cooties, right? Like, you can go in with your faith and come out intact. Yeah. But then number two, if it's not BLM, fine, right? But get involved. What I don't want to do is get involved in these endless debates. Well, can we, can't we? Because guess what? It's never going to be Christian enough for you. Because when it was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, they said it was Marxist. They said King was a Marxist or a socialist. They said they were violent. They said they were outside agitators. They said they were divisive. And it was explicitly Christian. Yeah. So it's not really the Christian thing or not. It's race.
Yes.
Now, one of the most compelling, there are a couple of the most compelling lines in the book, but when it comes to racism, the American church does not have a how-to problem, but a want-to problem. And then going back a page, many Christians today say they would have been active participants in the civil rights movement 50 years ago. Now, in the midst of a new civil rights movement, is their chance to prove it. You know, but exactly like you're saying, like, this is all great, but just do it, you know, do something. And I think there's another line. It's like, you know, the only wrong action is inaction.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, we talked about this at the top of the show. A lot of people think they would have been involved, but I don't think people grasp just how countercultural and risky it is to forcefully, vocally, actively fight against racism. If it was that easy and that simple, we'd have made a lot more progress by now, but it's not. And I think people are under the illusion right now, the folks who are sort of caught up in these endless debates in the Facebook comments or even at their churches about BLM, the organization, the principle, is it violence, is it Marxist, is it critical race theories? They're the exact same folks that King wrote about in Letter from a Birmingham Jail called the white moderate. Can be Black and brown moderate too. But these, should the Lord tarry and we live long enough to have some perspective on this time, I really think that it'll be these folks that many people look back to and say, where was the church? Why weren't more Christians involved? But thankfully, there are some Christians involved. And I think it's important for us to remember that progress has never been popular in terms of fighting racism, but it's always been a small, determined group of people who have not given up, who have maintained faith and hope and fought for progress, that we have what we have now. And so we should never look for a big old group to come along with us. I think we need to adjust our expectations. Even now, this wave of protests and uprisings after George Floyd's murder has died down a bit and the headlines have moved on. But what I firmly believe is just like when a wave crashes on the beach, it leaves behind shells and creatures and all of this stuff from the sea. I think when this wave recedes, there's going to be a remnant that's left behind that truly takes on racial justice as part of their lifestyle and fundamental disposition. And it's those folks, which is not the majority, but it's those folks who will make a difference.
Yeah, that calls to mind two things for me. Number one, you know, you saying that, you know, there are Christians involved with all this, both today and in the past. And it's one of the reasons why I don't enjoy it when people say, well, you know, we just have to judge people by the standards of their own time. Well, okay, let's do it. There were people that weren't okay with this, you know, throughout all of human history. So sure, we can do that.
Precisely. Yeah, that's the they were men of their time argument is what I often hear, and historical snobbery or arrogance to impose our ethical standards on people who lived 150 years ago. But you bring up the exact response that I usually give. I'm like, well, there were abolitionists when slavery was around. There were anti-segregationists when segregation was the order of the day. So the people who were against racial justice and racial equity were not the only people who had opinions. And so the other folks were people of their time as well.
And then the other place where what you're just saying makes me want to go, you know, I think, at least I hope, that we have established that there is an issue today. Right. And where I want to leave people with is talking about the ARC.
Yes. ARC, thank you.
The ARC of racial justice. I love a good acronym. So, you know, give people some action items. You know, what can they do if they're listening to this and like, okay, this is bad. I want to do something about it. What can they do?
Well, first, I've got a second book coming out in January 21, and it's called How to Fight Racism: Courageous Christianity and the Journey Toward Racial Justice. And it's an expansion on the concept of the ARC of racial justice. The ARC of racial justice is an acronym that stands for Awareness, Relationships, Commitment. My burden in this is that we would have a holistic approach to racial justice. And oftentimes we emphasize one factor or the other. If we're scholars, we love the awareness part. If we are church folks, we love the relationships part. If we're activists, we love the commitment part. We actually need all three, right? So awareness means building our knowledge about race and racism. I am biased. I think we need to build our historical knowledge as one of the primary ways. And you can do that by reading books, listening to podcasts like this. It's never been more accessible to learn about the history of race and racism. But there's all kinds of other things, from memoirs to sociology to psychology, that help us explain racism and white supremacy. But we have to move on from just head knowledge to heart knowledge, if you will, and that's relationships, right? That Christianity teaches us that all reconciliation is relational, that God wanted to reconcile a people, then God sent Jesus, the person, to establish relationships and to bring reconciliation between God and humankind, but as well as human beings and one another, right? So we have to put a face on all these data, on all this statistics, on all these problems, right? White evangelicals like to camp out there and say, well, some of my best friends are Black. I just had coffee with a person of color, right? So I'm not a racist because I treat people nicely. That's great. Keep doing that. Two thumbs up. But that's not enough. It's necessary, but not sufficient. This is where the commitment comes in, and it's a commitment to dismantling racist policies. It's a commitment to understanding the power dynamics of race, and that apart from anyone's individual feelings or attitudes, racism can work itself out in systems and institutions and practices. And so that's where we have to tackle voter suppression, mass incarceration, the racial wealth gap, education disparities, all of those things that get wrapped up in a racial caste system. And so I offer suggestions like commemorating Juneteenth as a national holiday, which makes it necessary and vital for us to remember race-based chattel slavery, how far we've come, but how far we still have left to go. I talk about taking down Confederate monuments and statues. I talk about reparations, which is always a fun topic for people, but specifically financial support for the Black community as repair for centuries of economic exploitation, which, by the way, extends well beyond race-based chattel slavery. So that's the last chapter. And then, like I said, I expand on it in a whole book in How to Fight mm-hmm. Racism.
I'm super excited to hear that you're coming out with a whole new book. I think that last section in this book, in The Color of Compromise, is really critical. I think you bring people to that point and they're like, oh my goodness, I had no idea. And this is like blowing my mind, all new. What do I do? And I'm grateful that you've got that end of the book.
That was it. The whole book was a setup to get to that last chapter.
Well, yeah, and a good one, I might add. John, any final questions? I could go on in so many directions, but I don't know if you have anything final that you want to ask.
There's tons of other places that we could go, but I mean, I think ending on some good action items is a good place to end. I mean, we could go on, but we'll go off on a wide tangent. Know.
Well, and so probably my last question then would be, because I think every author, anyone that writes their book, they have big hopes. In case people don't know, this book came out in 2019. You had no way to anticipate what 2020 was going to look like. Your life has been a lot busier, I'm sure. Yes. You know, you didn't know what history would hold. So when you wrote this, what's your deep down hope for people that pick it up and read it?
Yeah. So the last chapter of the book is called The Fierce Urgency of Now, and it's a phrase from King's I Have a Dream speech. And my hope for the book is that people would feel the fierce urgency of now. Now that you have this momentum of really tragic, depressing history of compromise and complicity with racism, you would feel a sense that I have to do something, and I have to do something now, because the time is now and long past for Christians in particular to help lead the fight against racism and to take even bigger strides on the journey toward racial justice. So my hope is that we would feel the fierce urgency of now.
I love that. Nothing more to say. Jamar Tisby, the author of The Color of Compromise, just such a joy, real honor to have you on the podcast. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
John, thanks for being along for the ride as well. Really appreciate you. And as always, to everyone else, I say keep the conversation going. And this time, go out and do something beyond that.